It's good to see everybody here this morning. We have several of our own members who are about to go through a big life change. We have several who are either about to get married in the next couple weeks or who are engaged to be married in the future or who have only recently been married in the last year or two. And of course, on top of all of that, we have people who've been married for 10 years and 20 years and even 60 years. There's a great diversity here at Monte Vista in terms of marital experience. So it is sometimes difficult to put together a lesson on marriage that I think would be useful for anybody who is listening, regardless of their experience with marital union. But one thing I think that every married couple should consider is boredom in their marriage. One writer put it really well in an article called Relationship Boredom Can Be Deadly. It is very disquieting, he writes, when perfect marriages end. The ones that are agreeable, orderly, peaceful, the ones that display no rancor, no rages, no infidelity, no egregious acts of galloping selfishness. When such marriages end, everyone is dismayed. How is it possible? They had no troubles at all, we say in disbelief, but maybe that's the key. No troubles at all may mean no challenge, no emotion, no surprises, no change. In other words, boring. Some marriages do die of boredom. Boring marriages are much more likely to suffer from sins of omission than from sins of commission. What isn't done gets such marriages into more trouble than what is done. Boredom can be the silent killer in any marriage, because we don't usually realize that it exists in our hearts until some sin has set in. And often, married couples will only look at each other after decades and realize they simply don't like staring at each other anymore. Or, at the very least, they're emotionally unattached and indifferent to each other. Contrary to the world's very common perception of marriage, though, God's intention for matrimony is that a married couple actually likes each other, enjoys each other, is engaged with each other, and is satisfied with the relationship, challenged and constantly stimulated from the very beginning of the relationship until the end of the relationship when one or both of them passes away. We're actually expected by God to savor the relationship that we have with our spouse, and it is only when we allow selfishness and boredom to creep in that relationship loses its fire. I'm reminded of Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9 where it says, "Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life." A great lesson that can be learned from Ecclesiastes 9 verse 9 is that there is no expiration date that is placed on that. In fact, the writer goes out of his way to say, "All the days of your fleeting life." You know what that tells me? All the days doesn't just include your honeymoon days. And all the days doesn't just include the time when you have money in the bank. And all the days does not include the time, or does not only include the time when you're young and healthy. All the days of your fleeting life is everything in between the good days, everything after the good days, everything that comes before the good days. All the days of your life is the bad days as well as the good days. And whether you have money in the bank, a nice house, health, wealth, or youth, it doesn't matter to Ecclesiastes 9 verse 9. Enjoy life with the person who you love all the days of your fleeting life. Add to that Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 18 where it says, "Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth." You know what that verse says? Rejoice in the wife of your youth. Means that there is no expiration date on what could possibly be a very satisfying, long-term marriage. Any marriage can be a satisfying, long-term marriage. And a lot of people look back on who they were when they were 20 or 25 or 30 when they first got married, and they wonder, where did that person go? They look at their spouse and they say, "You've changed. You're not the same person that you were before." And yet this verse flies in the face of that attitude that says, "Rejoice and let your fountain be blessed. Rejoice in the wife of your youth." Even if the wife of your youth and yourself are 50 years older and life isn't exactly the same that it was when you first got married and were enjoying your honeymoon period, you rejoice in the wife of your youth, even if you're not a youth anymore. Having a satisfying marriage results in exhilaration, Proverbs 5 and verse 19, and that is for both parties. But let's be clear about something here. When I talk about boring marriage, that boring is a very relative term. What might be very boring for one couple is not necessarily boring for another couple. And we shouldn't look at our marriages and say, well, because we have boring activities that we do, that must mean there's something wrong in our marriage. Well, no, just because you're boring people doesn't mean there's anything wrong with your marriage. I mean, just because you enjoy watching that 2 or 3 hour long marathon of House Hunters International on HGTV, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with your marriage. Or because you're looking forward to both of you reading a really good book on separate sides of your bed, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with your marriage. Or throwing in Star Trek The Next Generation on Blu-ray for a couple episodes, it doesn't mean that you're in a boring marriage. The thing is, boring is a relative term. And so I just want you to understand when I say that marriages die from boredom, there is a big difference between being in a boring marriage and being bored in your marriage. A boring marriage, by somebody's definition, might actually be an incredibly satisfying marriage just because somebody else out there says, oh, they're really boring people, but they might be very happy, boring people. And again, there's a difference between being boring and being bored. And being bored is the problem. Where you are not stimulated any longer, and you are not excited anymore, and you don't care, and there isn't investment, and there isn't challenge anymore in the relationship, that's being bored. And especially when you just don't care anymore. When you've tried everything else, and you've read all the self-help books, and you just don't care anymore. Now, in the first couple years of marriage, nobody's bored. At the very least, you spend all your time arguing in the first couple years of marriage because you're trying to figure each other out. It's when you've been married for a few years, maybe a few decades. It's when life is nothing but one activity after another, one soccer practice after another, one Sunday after another. It's when you're no longer exciting each other. So what I would like to do with our lesson this morning is to give you some things that define boring marriage. That boring marriage is this, never that. And we'll start with this. That boring marriage is always minimal. It is never excessive in nature. The same writer goes on to say, boring marriages are minimal marriages, not marriages of excess. Minimal because they exclude all of the excitement of a relationship, conflict, differences, spontaneity, feelings, irrationality, passion. And sometimes we throw out the baby with the bathwater when it comes to the subject of passion, because passion sometimes involves arguing with each other. And we would rather be in a marriage that is at peace, that never challenges us, than to be in a marriage that does challenge us, that every now and then results in an argument. We'd rather just sit quietly with somebody who makes us uncomfortable than to be uncomfortable for a few moments with somebody that we really love. That's the problem when you throw out passion. When passion is not a part of your marriage anymore, yes, maybe you've thrown out passion, you've thrown out arguing, you've thrown out differences, but you've thrown out some of the very things that make marriage worth our time, worth our while, and worth the time in this life. Yes, when you throw out impetuousness and temper tantrums, and you throw out presumptuousness, you also throw out humor and flirtiness and romance at the same time if you're not careful. And these things are wholly irreplaceable in a marriage without passion. Passion may have its downsides at times, but learning to control it rather than abandon it altogether will keep a marriage fresh for many years. When we keep marriages minimal, we do that because we don't want to get hurt. There's always the possibility that a spouse might harm us. That if I open myself up to my spouse, if I really reveal who I am, my vulnerability, so to speak, that I might get taken advantage of. That if I stick my neck out for somebody, it just might get chopped off. That if I take a risk for somebody, the risk might not pay off. In a lot of marriage counseling situations, what I find is that one person in the couple wants to take the risk. They want to be fully invested. They want to jump into marriage head first. But they've tried it so many times and they've been hurt by it that they're not willing to do it anymore. And so you have two people on opposite ends of a chasm who are not willing to jump to each other because so often one of them has jumped and just fallen alone. Without anybody there. We can't live like that. We have to take the risk. Let me give you an example of that from the Bible. The book Song of Solomon, in my interpretation of the book at least, is about a poor woman who is found by a great and wealthy king. This great and wealthy king does everything he can to woo this poor woman. He offers her the world, offers her treasures, offers her everything that she could ever dream of, and yet her heart is with a poor shepherd boy who has nothing to give her. And in his shame, he hides. In his shame, he thinks that he could not possibly compete with the great and wealthy king. What does she do, though? Does she give up? Does she go and marry the great and wealthy king? Does she give up on her heart, on her romance, on her dreams? No, of course she does not. She seeks after the poor boy. She looks for that shepherd boy. She pines away after him. She sacrifices for him. And as we see in Song of Solomon chapter 5, verses 6 through 8, in what I believe is a dream that is racking her brain, that is bringing incredible pain to her life, she says, I opened to my beloved. That's the vulnerability. I opened to my beloved. But my beloved had turned away and had gone. Sometimes that happens. We open to our beloved and we get hurt. My heart went out to him as I spoke. I searched for him, but I did not find him. I called to him, but he did not answer. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city, they found me. They struck me and wounded me. The guardsmen of the walls took away my shawl from me. What they're doing is they're shaming her. They're saying, why would you choose a lowly shepherd boy over the great and wealthy king? Why waste your time with a boy like that? He's out there with the stinky livestock. You could be living with the king in his palace. Shame on you. Shame on you for choosing romance over practicality, over materialism. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, as to what you will tell him, I am lovesick. That's vulnerability right there. She was so invested in her love that she would endure ridicule for her love's sake. Because she would rather be in love and mocked by everybody around her than to live in a sham of a marriage with a king who just wants to add her to his harem. Boring marriage is minimal, never excessive. Boring marriage is not about emotional investment and vulnerability. Boring marriage is about safety. Boring marriage is about keeping things safe. And I'll give you a few examples of this for you to ponder. When you're totally committed to a person, it can be both frightening and comforting at the same time, depending on what your perspective is. It can be frightening to know that your love may fail you one day, that your love may disappoint you, that your love may hurt you, that you might open yourself up to a husband or a wife, and that same person might not always turn out to be the perfect knight in shining armor that you imagined he would be. But when both parties in a marriage take the vow to total commitment seriously, there's a freedom that's found that can be found in no other earthly relationship. The result is this, that I can expose my deepest, most shameful flaws, knowing that he will expose his flaws too. I can speak my mind in complete honesty, knowing that no argument will ever be able to separate us. I can be who I am without a facade, knowing that I am seeing the true her as well. I can let my guard down, knowing that she will not take advantage of me when I do. I can be honest about my relationship with God, knowing that he struggles with sin and temptation just as I do. I can let go of all of my hang-ups and my baggage and my preconceptions, knowing that there is strength in leaning on each other rather than on our emotional crutches. Excessive marriage may be more challenging, but excessive marriage is also more rewarding. I may open myself up to criticism and disagreement, but I also experience the power of maturation and growth and experience, like Proverbs 27 says, iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. That's as true in our friendships, in our business acquaintances, in our religious relationships, as it is in our marriage. But boring marriage is also purely functional, never emotional. Our marriages become boring when we stop seeing our spouse as God intended us to see them, and we see them only as a kind of function of something. My wife is the mother of my children. My husband is the breadwinner of my household. My spouse is the person that I have sex with. He is the person who pays for my house. She is the person who cleans my house. When we start seeing a spouse as nothing but a function and not as a person, a marriage like that falls apart. And even when we pigeonhole a person into terms like husband, wife, mother, or father, we are sometimes using very limiting terms. Consider a couple of Bible passages that were more about function than about substance. First of all, Ahasuerus and Vashti. Go to Esther chapter 1 in the Old Testament. And we're introduced in Esther chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, to Ahasuerus and his wife, Vashti. Now, it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, that he gave a banquet for all the princes in attendance, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory, the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Susa, the capital, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. He showed off all of these things in verse 6, all of his many, many treasures. In verse 7, drinks were served in golden vessels. Verse 8, the drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion. For so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. And in verse 9, Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Now here is where the trouble comes in. And you see what kind of a marriage that Ahasuerus and Vashti had. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded all of these individuals, whose names I don't feel like pronouncing right now, to bring in, verse 11, Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs, and the king became very angry and his wrath burned within him. There's a lot of things that are dysfunctional about their marriage. And we could certainly talk for a while about what was wrong in this situation. But like many rulers of his day, Ahasuerus simply wanted to display all of his stuff. And among his stuff was his beautiful trophy wife. He wanted to show her off. He was plenty inebriated to do so, yet not so much that he didn't know what he was doing. The text states in verse 11 that he wanted to display her beauty to the people and the princes, and she refused. Now, apparently he was no longer satisfied with the control that he had over his queen, Vashti, so he sends her away and vows to marry another person. And here's the lesson. Like many marriages today, the king was apparently only interested in marrying a person for her beauty and the image that came along with that. How many marriages do we see sometimes today that only have to do with that? I marry somebody because I'm attracted to that person, and that's just about it. Well, I marry somebody because he or she has money in their family, and that's, well, just about it. I marry somebody because he or she is a celebrity or has some kind of social cachet, and that's just about it. And when your trophy wife breaks down and doesn't want to parade herself around the way you've asked her to, what are you left with? Ahasuerus and Vashti didn't really have a marriage once that part of their marriage broke down. And if she's not going to be the prancing, parading trophy wife that he asked her to be, then what point is there in even being married to Vashti anymore? But I'll give you another one also. Jacob and the sisters, Leah and Rachel. In Genesis chapter 29 and Genesis chapter 30, we see the way that this situation devolves. It becomes an absolute mess, a comedy of errors, so to speak. Jacob is tricked by his soon-to-be father-in-law into marrying the sister who he was not actually in love with, and he never makes any bones about it. He loved Rachel. He made that very clear. He made it clear before they were married. He made it clear while they were courting. He made it clear after they were married and after he'd married Leah. He always loved Rachel. But he was tricked into marrying Leah. So what are you going to do but marry Rachel also and become a polygamist? Now these two sisters, who I'm sure at some point in their life must have had some sisterly affection toward each other, end up becoming rivals in this marriage. And they see themselves as nothing but a function. And they see Jacob as nothing but a function. In your own time, you can read these two chapters of Genesis 29 and chapter 30. But I'll give you one verse to ponder here in chapter 30, verse 1. This is what Rachel says when she looks at her situation and she is childless. Leah, she's having plenty of babies. But Rachel, she says, "Give me children, or else I die." Is that what her marriage had become? Is that it? If I'm not able to have children, then I might as well die. If I'm not able to have children, then I might as well not even exist. If I'm not able to have children, what point is there in continuing on in this life, being married to you, even breathing air any longer? Give me children, or else I die. Later on, one of the sisters actually buys Jacob. She says, "I bought you tonight. I paid for you with some parsnips. Now get on in here. Let's make some babies." And it becomes ridiculous to where one of them has a baby and the other one has a baby, and then she gets her handmaid and says, "Well, here, start having babies with my handmaid." And the other one says, "Oh yeah, well, I've got a handmaid too, so you better watch out." She brings in her handmaid, and they're making babies here and babies there, and they're arguing with each other. And the names that they pick for their babies are ridiculous also. Read the names of the 12 sons of Jacob sometime, and you will see the battle played out between these two women. All they saw in their marriage was a function. It was a purely functional marriage, so that even Jacob and Rachel, who claimed to have loved each other, found very little love anymore in this relationship. And one more. Abigail and Nabal in 1 Samuel chapter 25. In 1 Samuel chapter 25, we meet David, not quite a king yet, but out there with his merry band performing goodly deeds. And he helps some of the servants of Nabal who come back to their master, and they say, "There's this guy David out there with his merry band, and he's doing good deeds out there, and he came to our assistance, and we really should help him." Nabal's response, of course, is ridiculous. He says, "Who is David? I don't know this David guy, this son of Jesse. Let's have nothing to do with him." Of course, David finds out about that and takes it as a personal affront. And he gets all of his band of merry men together, and they're going to go and they're going to deal with Nabal, because he's angry at Nabal for being selfish and rude and coarse. But on the way, Nabal's wife Abigail meets David with a great big present. And she says, "Please forgive my husband Nabal. He's a completely worthless man. His name even means worthless." You know, the Hebrews really had that penchant for naming their children. I wonder why it was that Nabal's mom and dad said, "Let's name our son Worthless." But Abigail says his name means worthless, and so he is. He's a worthless man. And in that maneuvering, Abigail is able to calm David down and save Nabal's household from certain destruction. David, of course, is impressed with Abigail. She's a great woman. Abigail, in my opinion, is one of the greatest women in the Bible. Truly a remarkable example of a person who endured much at the hands of what we really see is a worthless man, a worthless husband. Why is it that Abigail and Nabal ever got married in the first place then? You have a dynamic, exciting, interesting, intelligent, godly woman who marries a worthless fellow. How did that ever happen? Well, most marriages in this time period, especially marriages between wealthy families, such as Nabal's family, were arranged marriages. They were marriages about business connections, political connections, clout. It is most likely, and I know the text doesn't say it specifically, but it is most likely that Abigail was forced to marry Nabal for some kind of business connection between families. And here's the reality today. Sometimes a truly wonderful, godly person ends up marrying someone who is not who he or she thinks that they will be. Somebody puts on a front and a facade. They act godly. They seem godly. They seem like they're someone you'd want to marry. And after a few years, you realize this is false advertising if there ever was. And yet, look at Abigail. She stayed married to a man who probably only married her for a function, a business connection. She stayed married to a man who did not see romance in their marriage or love or unselfishness or self-sacrifice. He saw her as a function, and that's it. Compare all of these unhappy couples to God's ideal marital situation, and there is a real disparity. Like I already read in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9 and Proverbs chapter 5, marriage is supposed to be a joy to us, an exhilaration, in fact. In Proverbs 31 verse 29, many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. Those are not the words of a man who sees his wife only as a function. Those are the words of a man who sees his wife as a dynamic creation of God. Song of Solomon 2 and verse 2. Like a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens. Song of Solomon 5 and verse 10. My beloved is dazzling and handsome, outstanding among 10,000. Here's the thing, my friends. If marriage is nothing but a function, then anybody can fill that role. If marriage is nothing but making babies, there's a lot of people that can do that. If marriage is nothing but having financial security, you can probably find that in somebody. If marriage is nothing but social status or political clout, sure, you can find a person who fills that function. Sex and money and clout and cachet and popularity, that is a dime a dozen. That is 10,000 people you can find that can fill that function. But when you have the attitude of the woman in Song of Solomon who says, "That's my beloved, outstanding among 10,000. That's marriage. That's marriage. And the last point is this. Boring marriage is uninteresting. Boring marriage lacks friendship. Boring marriage lacks companionship. The writer that we quoted early on, Sanford, said, "Finally, you are forced to suffer a boring marriage when you don't know how to make it interesting." As a nation, we have become so dependent on the entertainment industry for stimulation that we've lost the ability to stimulate ourselves and thus to draw forth what is interesting in our partners. I think that's a good point that he's making here. If you spend all of your time watching television and reading things on the internet and scrolling through Facebook, all you're doing is stimulating yourself with an outside source, with outside information, and you're constantly having things thrown at you. You're not able to think analytically, to imagine within your own mind. You're not creative anymore. And if you're not imaginative and you're not creative, then how do you think it's possible to be married to someone and draw out their creativity and their imagination as well? And so married couples end up simply being two people who are stimulated by outside forces rather than being stimulated by each other. It's not always that we should have something to talk about. In fact, my opinion is that it's a very healthy sign in a marriage when two people are able to not talk about something for a while. I feel like sometimes the person you're most comfortable with in this world is the one that you could spend 3 hours in the car with, not feeling like you have to talk about something. Because what's more uncomfortable than being in the car with someone for 3 hours and feeling like you have to say something? Oh, that's just miserable, right? That's just awful. But you know, good friends and a good marriage is when you could be in a car for 3 hours, not needing to say something and being perfectly comfortable, being perfectly at ease with that person. So it's not always having to have something to talk about. It's not always about filling a void or being like, what do you think about this whole Trump thing? That's not what it's about. But is there any of that in your marriage? Is there any of that where you're able to draw something out in somebody and have interesting conversations at some point? Or is your marriage just superficial talking points? I saw on the news today that there was a house fire in Mesa. And in other news, good news for egg lovers. Do you still find your mate interesting? Or have all of his or her stories become boring to you? Are conversations dull? Perhaps there's a need for our married couples to fill their lives with more interactive, more thought-provoking and substantial activities rather than just television. A few suggestions, just in practical terms. Try exercising together, playing games together, Yahtzee. Actually, if you're married to Rebecca, don't play Yahtzee with Rebecca. But simple things, games like Yahtzee, that could be a fun evening together. Just playing simple games like that together. Reading the same book and then talking about each chapter. Of course, that won't work in our marriage. She wants to read sci-fi and fantasy novels, and I just want to read about World War I. Going on vacations alone. Vacations don't always have to be family vacations. Studying the Bible together. Conducting Bible studies together and getting more involved at church. If there's something that can be done at church, why not do it together? I remember my parents would often sign up to clean the building. We didn't have a Sherilyn back at Beaverton. So they would sign up together to clean the building, and they would go out on a Saturday evening together. They'd go get dinner somewhere, fast food or whatever, and they'd go clean the building together. And that was their way of being together. It's a simple thing, fast food and church building cleaning, but it was time that they could be together. Activities like that, are there things that you can do? If you're going to have to fill communion cups, can't you fill communion cups together? We're our companions and best friends. We're not business partners. There are plenty of other relationships that we engage in that lack engagement and stimulation in a meaningful sense. Don't let your marriage become one of them. Don't let your marriage become little more than being glorified roommates. It has to be more than that. Song of Solomon 5, verse 16. The Shulamite woman says this of the poor shepherd boy that she loves so very much. This is my beloved, and he's my friend. This is my beloved, and he's my friend. Rejoice in the wife of your youth and be exhilarated at all times by her love. Do you and your spouse explore anything anymore? Do you and your spouse discover anything? Do you and your spouse grow? Do you talk? Do you engage? You might have a very boring marriage if you don't. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, I'd be remiss if I didn't offer an invitation. Please listen to the words of Jesus Christ as he says in Mark 16, verse 16, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. So I encourage you, whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing. Thank you.